Welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This week's episode is with none other than Brad Feld. Brad is an incredibly successful investor, having founded Techstars Accelerator, Foundry Group, but is also known as one of the kindest guys in the business. This episode, we talk about how Brad rejects the term career, his principles of time management, why he doesn't have kids, mental health and startups, his thoughts on romantic relationships, ego management, and much more. As one listener remarked, this episode is basically a how-to on life, and there's no better person to do it than Brad. All right, let's take Brad. Brad, welcome to Products on Live.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's so much we want to get into, but first I wanted to start off with when you were in high school and in college, what did you think you wanted to be when you grew up? What did you think your career path was going to be?
Well, it's a bizarre question for me to answer because I never had the idea of a career path. When I was 10, my dad was a doctor, and his dad came to America, was an immigrant. And when my dad was a kid, his dad said to him, "You can be anything you want as long as it's a doctor." And my dad would tell me that story. And when I was 10, I walked into his office and said, "Dad, I don't want to be a doctor." Because I hated like going on rounds with him. I hated the whole doctor thing. And he said, he reminded me of his father's story. And he said to me, "Brad, you can be anything you want." And so I carried that around since I was about 10. And when I went to school, I had already worked the summer before my first year of college. I'd worked for a startup as their first software developer. And I did that for the first year in college. So kind of from the very beginning, I was always working as somebody writing software, working for startups. And I started my first business while I was in school. So I never really thought about what is my career going to be. And that's why it's a bizarre question to me.
Why does it not? What's the big misconception with the term? Is it too linear?
Yeah. I mean, I get what people mean when they say career. I understand it conceptually. I think "What Color Is Your Parachute" was a book that came out maybe when I was in high school or in my 20s and was like the popular book, and sort of the notion of developing a career came out. I went to MIT, and when I was a freshman, like the idea of what you did when you graduate was important. And so people would be talking about, I got a $40,000 engineering job at such and such a company. But I never connected to any of that. None of it ever felt like me. And so, even today, I'm 50. When I think back, what's my career been? It's not really a career. It's just a bunch of shit that I've done.
Ask you now, you're at parties and people say, if people don't already know who you are, they say, "What do you do?"
When somebody says to me, "What do? I actually now answer, "I try to have a happy life." it depends on, first, I don't like to go to parties, so I don't go to that many parties, but let's assume I went to a party. My answer is probably more around, I invest in early stage technology companies. I help people start companies, something like that. I mean, I try to get away from the "what do you do" question pretty quickly because I find it to be the least interesting thing to talk about. I also happen to live in Boulder where nobody asks you what you do. They ask you, when they say "what do you do," they mean, do you run marathons, do Ironmans, do you rock climb, right? So it's context matters. Like on the East Coast, they say, "Where did you go to school?" Right? That whole thing of the different places mean different things. But I think fundamentally, what I do is try hard to learn and teach every day and be involved in lots of things that are stimulating to me and stimulating to others.
When you think about, sort of what ties your, and I don't want to use the career word, but sort of the shit you've done together in terms of interests, is it as broad as working with cool people on cool problems? Or what from an interest, like what ties the stuff you've done together?
What ties it all together? I've always been very obsessed about technology. I love science fiction. I've been reading science fiction since I was that 10-year-old me was reading science fiction. I I think about what we are as a species, as humans. So I'm actually of the mindset that we're not the only species. And the notion that we're the only sentient beings in the universe makes no sense to me. So I'm very fascinated with this idea of our current reality is such a tiny, tiny, tiny time slice of whatever simulation we're part of. And so I'm just incredibly curious about things that continuously change and impact how we interact with that. And at some point, I think I came to the conclusion that I had to limit the range of that. So, you know, technology is one range, philosophy is another range, you know, history, politics, like there's all different kinds of places you can go with it. And my fundamental nerdness really had me captured by creating shit. And software was the easy stuff for me. I had a very, very hard time with anything that was physical. My wife Amy likes to say that I have a very challenged relationship with the physical world. And I'm not permitted to get on a bicycle anymore. I've had two very serious bike accidents. Both of them were by myself. Right. So, it's not the absent-minded professor problem. It's a something about physical space is not as comfortable for me than virtual. I'd much rather be sitting doing this than together somewhere. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that I'm not willing to or able to sit with other people and interact with them, but this is better for me.
Hence the no parties. Or the few parties.
I spent a lot of time. I spent a lot of time traveling, probably 75% of the time for 20-something years. And a big part of my own personal struggles, with my energy level, sustaining it, depression, getting completely physiologically exhausted, has a lot to do with interacting with the physical space. So it's not just that I crash bikes, but that I don't really have a particularly good governor. Anyway, that's enough on the physical world. But I think for me, it's much more the software piece started because I could actually do it comfortably. And I love the idea of not lack of collaborative work, because of course, software development is today very collaborative. And even, 30 years ago, it was pretty collaborative. But I like the abstraction of it. And what's happened over time is I've gotten much, much more comfortable with hardware, but hardware in the context of the way we describe it in a Foundry Group, which is software wrapped in plastic. So the idea that it's things like, Fitbit or Glowforge, which is, it's a piece of hardware, mm-hmm. but the magic of Glowforge goes well beyond just the hardware. The software is actually part of the absolute brilliance of what a company like them or a company like MakerBot is doing.
Let's talk about the traveling thing for a second. Did you know that it was killing you and still doing it? Was it a self-awareness problem, or was it just what was the problem there? That why didn't you stop?
Yeah, it was not. I was not aware of it in a long arc way. I would describe it much more as a moderator abstainer problem. On the spectrum of being a moderator or being an abstainer, I don't really know how to moderate very well. Right, I don't run to stay fit. I run marathons. Right. I don't drink that much. My parents didn't drink, so I grew up in a household without alcohol. But it's very, very hard for me to have one glass of wine deliberately. Like if I have a glass of wine and nobody comes by and pours another glass, I can stop. But if it's a bottomless pour because you're in a restaurant where they keep pouring more wine, you're drinking it. Yeah. And so on any dimension, whether it's physical or intellectual, I'm not shallow about what I like to pursue. I go very, very deep because I don't moderate it. The end result of that was the travel was very linked to that dynamic for me. I really didn't think about putting limits on what I was doing as a way of nurturing myself, but instead I couldn't moderate. And it wasn't until 2013, I guess the summer of 13 to the summer of 2014, I didn't get on an airplane except for two times, both vacations. The first time in my life for 52 weeks, I didn't travel.
Wow.
Almost every week. And it was awesome. And it recalibrated and reprogrammed a lot of the ways I think about my work and how I do my work. But I categorize that very clearly as the abstainer moderator problem.
And in terms of the travel specifically, is it because you are somewhat of an introvert, if you even accept that sort of dichotomy of introvert extrovert slash need alone time? Or
Well, I accept the dichotomy. I'm a deep introvert that is very, very comfortable in an extrovert environment. So, my definition of introvert extrovert for people that don't really, you know, grok the words is spending time with a bunch of people depletes an introvert, and spending time alone fills up the tank. And an extrovert's the opposite. Spending time alone depletes the extrovert, and spending time with a bunch of other people fill up the tank. So I can spend a lot of time with lots of other people. It just depletes the tank. So that's part one. Part two is now that I'm 50, it's easy to reflect. When I was 25, I felt completely indestructible. Even when I was 35, I felt pretty indestructible. We're not indestructible. when you're 50, you had plenty of people who die normally. I mean, it's tragic because it's young, but die from stuff. And all of a sudden you realize that, you know, it is a finite phenomena, and the fatigue is not just something you can sort of work through. And then for me, the fatigue manifests itself in lots of other ways, as it does with many people, in terms of it having emotional and mental health impacts. So as I get more and more worn out, I power through. I'm very functional, but that doesn't mean I feel good or I'm happy or I'm in a good place. Right. And it's worse and worse. And in the absence of being able to define a limit, right, the abstainer moderator problem again, you don't realize, well, I just got to moderate. I just got to take it easy this week.
Right. And it's interesting. There's some people who are, and maybe you are to some extent, a combination of, you know, recharged when they're alone, but also like to communicate with a mass audience, you know, like to write, like to tweet. You know, Chris Sacca comes to mind. You know, someone moved to Truckee, right, to sort of get away from the coffee meetings, but loves sort of the mass communication on Twitter.
Well, separate the activities, right? So I live in Boulder deliberately, right? I'm right here. I don't remember where it was in my adult life, but somewhere in my 20s, I became very fascinated with Warren Buffett and the idea that this guy lived in Omaha.
Yeah.
And I formed early this view that you could live wherever you want and you should live where you want to live and then build your life around it. And that was part of the moving from Boston to Boulder. I have lots of friends here. I used to travel a lot, so I was constantly going to other places. I have lots of people that come to me. I mean, you know, Dan and his team at Glowforge are here today to spend a chunk of time. And we're going to have very deep, thoughtful, uninterrupted time, right? So it's not that I flew somewhere, I'm exhausted, because I flew from somewhere else and I'm here for the meeting and I want to get out of the meeting as quickly as I can to go back home or to the obligatory dinner and then get up early the next morning and go somewhere else. We just have whatever time we have, starting, you know, at 3 p.m, going until when we're done. So I think that's very separate from communicating to a lot of people, to sharing things, to having a voice. And I think having a voice, if you're comfortable that judgment of your voice is not the thing you're searching for an answer to, and you're willing to just put your voice out there for some reason, and reason for me is mostly to think out loud and to learn and right, get feedback and to be exposed, you know, get interwoven with interesting things. Being physically with a lot of people and trying to do that is actually incredibly inefficient.
Yep.
Right. So this notion that you're trying to do it by being physically interacting with a lot of people is maybe the least efficient way to have those kinds of goals. If your goals are different, right? If your goals are to build a transactional relationship, right? It's actually in some ways easier to build a transactional relationship face to face, right? That's why people still do that.
Right.
But, you know, do I need to fly to, you know, wherever you are to get in a studio with you to be face to face to talk about how? No, it's very inefficient. And so I think part of the joy of separating those two constructs, right, and sort of on a ramble, but the ramble is the two constructs are one, this notion of being around a lot of other people and interacting with them. And the second is having a voice for a goal. And I think the miss for a lot of people is that they don't separate those two.
Right. And I'm asking because I think I have something similar where I could see myself doing something like that. So this question is, how do you deal with the person who says, hey, you know, I haven't seen you in 6 months or a year, and I miss you. You know, I'd love to see you in person. You know, we've been chatting over email, but I haven't seen you. And, you know, there's too many people that say that, or you can't make it, but you want to appreciate that person.
Yeah, it varies. So, I'll give an example. This morning, I sent an email to a friend who lives in Boston who I haven't seen in a while, somebody I've done a lot of stuff with over the years. And I sent him a note. I said, I miss you. When are our paths going to cross again? You know, dinner's on me wherever we are. And he sent me back a note pretty quickly and said, you know, you beat me to it. I was thinking the same thing a couple of days ago, and I just hadn't got around to it. I'm going to be in Boulder on such and such a day for a thing that I happen to be here for as well. I said, great, let's lock it down now. It's in May. We'll get together and dinner in May. That's very different than the, you know, 50 emails a day that I get from people who say, can we have coffee? And the answer is no. I have 24 hours a day. I'm going to spend, as I'm getting older, I'm spending more, not less of them sleeping. So I'm going to spend, you know, 8 of them sleeping. My Fitbit tells me I need 8 hours of sleep, so I believe it. I'm going to spend 8 hours sleeping, and I'm going to spend a chunk of time with Amy, and I'm going to spend a chunk of time by myself, and then I've got some stuff I got to do. And when you add it all up, I don't got much time left. And I'm going to spend that time deliberately how I want rather than reactively. And so that's how I've started to process it. I used to meet with a lot more people. Mm-hmm. I would say, feel the need to meet with a lot more people. And I realized I don't have to meet with them to still have an interaction with them. And so the issue is somebody says, "Do I have coffee?" is they say, "No, let's go back and forth an email. What do you want to talk about?"
Yep.
And a lot of times people say, "I don't know. I just wanted to meet you." I'm like, "Okay."
Yeah. I think a good example of someone to bring up in that context is Ben Casnoka. You know, your friend for a long time and a recent friend of mine who, you know, struck up a friendship with you at a very young age. And the reason I'm asking is for people who want to build relationships or friendships with very busy people. Talk about the Ben story. And
sure. I met Ben. He was probably 14. I was at Mobius at the time, and he came in to our office. He was the son of a friend of one of the partners. And he came to pitch us his business called Comcade. And it was a couple $100,000 a year business, 14-year-old, incredibly precocious. I remember what he was dressed in. He was wearing a white shirt, white dress shirt with this bright yellow tie. And he was a big kid. He was a big guy. I'm 6'1", and I always feel like I'm one of the taller people in the room, and Ben towers over me. And he reminded me a lot of me when I was 14. So I liked him a lot immediately, started a friendship with him, got together with him when I was in the Bay Area periodically as he got older. I think he came out to Boulder at some point, and Amy, my wife, and I spent some time with him, and we got into a rhythm. He was probably still a teenager. He was out of high school, but still a teenager, maybe 18 or 19 at this point, where we would get together once a year for a long weekend, 3-4 days. And that's continued for, I think he's 26, 27, 28, something. So, almost a decade. And, the emotional intimacy that you develop can be very powerful. And I think the relationship that he and I and Amy have developed, is a pretty profound one, because it's not paternalistic. It's peer, but with an age gap.
Right.
Right. I mean, he's probably, Amy and I didn't have kids, but you could imagine that we'd have kids. And, at this point, if we had kids early in our relationship, we could have kids in our 20s. So it's sort of in that, on the edge of that. It sort of is a business relationship, but not really. It's a life relationship. And, I've learned an enormous amount from him, and he's challenged me on a lot of things and made me think about a lot of stuff. And I hope vice versa. And fundamentally, it's the kind of relationship I want more of, not less of, right? You want those deep relationships where you're constantly learning from each other. You have this deep emotional intimacy. You don't have to be together all the time, right? You can see each other once a year for a couple of days. But that doesn't mean that you don't interact, but you don't have to interact all the time. You don't have to be interwoven in everything each other are doing.
One thing that I've talked about with Ben is that a lot of heroes in his life and my life don't have kids and have deliberately decided not to have kids. Is this something you've stayed the consistent thought as you've gotten older? How have you thought about it, and how do you advise people in our situation, late 20s, maybe early 30s, on,
Yeah, there's actually a really, really, really great line in the current House of Cards. I don't think it'll spoil anything for anybody, but one of the characters asks Claire, "Do you regret not having kids?" And Claire turns immediately and says back to the other character, "Do you regret having kids?" It's just like, it's perfect. And that actually describes how Amy and I think about it. Like, it's a choice. And, if you want to be reductionist about it, it's a 2x2 matrix, right? You have, each partner on one axis, and you have yes, yes, no, no, right? And if you're in the bottom box, no, no, easy. If you're in the top box, yes, yes, easy. And if you're in one of the other boxes, it's hard.
Right.
And what Amy and I did, the way we came to it, is every year we talked about it on the same day, which happened to be my birthday. So it was one of the birthday topics every year. We'd say, let's talk about it. You want to have kids? And the conversation never lasted more than 60 seconds. And for the first 5 or 6 years that we were together, brought it up every year. Nope. Okay. Talk about it next year. Brought it up next year. Nope. And when I was 31, I went and got fixed. And that's a pretty permanent decision. It's not a 100% permanent decision.
Right.
But it was deliberate. Like, it was a choice that we were making. And if at any point either of us had said yes, then we would have had a much longer than 60-second discussion. And I think that that's the essence of it. I think people default into, in American society in 2016, all of a sudden you start to feel pressure at some point to have kids. It's sociological pressure. It's the shit you see on TV. All your friends are having kids. Your parents are talking about their need for grandchildren. Well, whatever that is. And that may not be a 2016 thing. That's been going on probably since the beginning of man or beginning of humans. And the issue becomes, like so many other things we do, there's so much power if you're deliberate about your choices. And your choice of a yes is just as important as your choice of a no, and vice versa. And the miss is that so many times people don't spend the time to make a choice. You default into it. You think it's, required. It just sort of happens. So whether it's about kids or a business decision or a new product or a partnership or whatever, being deliberate about the decision is important.
In the moment when you thought, when you most wanted to have kids, or when you were most open, if there was even just one moment of, hey, maybe it would be cool, what was the reason why maybe it would be cool? Like, legacy?
We never had that moment.
Wow.
We really, literally never had that moment.
Wow.
There's probably a long list of reasons why we never had that moment, but there was never a, hey, maybe we should think about it. It was, are you interested? No. Are you interested? No. Okay.
Right. Right. Switching gears a bit, one thing we've gone back and forth on, and you've written for a long time about, and we alluded to earlier, is sort of is mental health, depression, especially as it relates to startups. Obviously, not exclusive to startups, but that's just the world we're in. You've been writing about it for years now. Have you seen it get better? Have you seen it get worse?
Separate two things. One is the issue of mental health, and the other is a discussion of the issue. I don't think the issue has changed at all. I think that it's the same issue that's always existed. I mean, I talk openly about my own struggles, that have gone back 30 years or 25 years. I know plenty of other people who have struggled. There's lots of sort of anecdotal stories, that go back in time. And then there's, sort of lots of speculation. And then there's some people that are very famous that have come out late in life and talked about their own struggles at different points in their career, but very few. But I don't think that's changed. I don't think the pressure and the dynamics and the stress and the triggers and the things that cause instantiation of different kinds of mental health issues, whether it be anxiety or depression or something more significant, I don't think that's changed. I think what has changed, and I think it's only changed in the last couple of years, but I think it has changed meaningfully, is our ability to talk about the issues and explore the issue and try to understand it. And I use the word ability. I thought about it for a sec, and then I thought about it after I used it. I think ability is the right word. There is still an enormous stigma associated with any sort of mental health issues, especially in the context of business. You know, long list of easy things to talk about that are uncomfortable, right? If I talk about being depressed, does that mean that people are going to be afraid to invest in me? If I talk about being anxious, will that mean that people won't follow me as a leader? Or whatever, right? You know, go down the list of how you talk about it. If I talk about that I do therapy, will people look at me differently? That's different than the ability to even talk about, like, this is normal, right? If you're a CEO and you say you've never had a day that was fucked up, you're lying. You're full of shit. I mean, it's just not true. If you're a CEO and you said you've never had a day, or a founder, you've never had a day where you woke up in the morning and you felt like a fraud, you felt like an imposter, you felt like you couldn't get out of bed, you were afraid of what was going to happen. Okay, whatever. I mean, maybe you're a mutant, right? You're different. That's not how it works. Like, we're humans. We're bags of chemicals, and the bags of chemicals mix in different kinds of ways. And so I think what has really fundamentally changed is our ability as a startup community, as a very broad worldwide thing, right? We're talking about startups all the time around the world. This is now becoming part of the conversation. And I don't think that solves anything, but just making it okay for it to be part of the conversation, I think, is critically important.
What's the next evolution of that? Once we are talking about it, what can we do?
Yeah, I think it happens bottoms up, not top down. I think there's a lot of discussions about how to change things structurally. I don't think any of that stuff probably manifests itself. I see it just within, for example, the companies we've invested in, and the use of coaching, and the ability of peers to talk to each other about their struggles. And the fact that when we've made an investment in a new company and one of the founders is struggling, that they feel like they can be safe raising the issue and asking for some people that they can talk to, which isn't necessarily me, but, you know, hey, I saw that person X has talked openly about their own struggles. Are they willing to talk about it? Or I'm having these feelings. Are they normal? Like, even the fact that those can be surfaced bottom up in a founder investor or founder to founder interaction, I think is hugely impactful, and it builds over time.
In your darkest moments, what did you find that was most grounding or most helpful?
Couple things. One is I would call out Amy specifically. So having a partner who is not trying to fix you, but is willing to be supportive and engage in whatever you're going through. Like, understands that you're going through something. It's not simple, and it's not their problem or their solution to address directly, but that they can help enormously through just their involvement and engagement with you. So that's thing one. Thing two is friends that have similar characteristics. And an example of that, I had several friends, one of my closest friends and oldest friends, my first business partner, who knew me when I was depressed the first time and knows me probably as well as anybody on this planet, Dave. He would call me up a couple of years ago when I struggled for about 6 months. He would call me up and say, hey, I'm nearby, I want to go for a walk. And what Dave knew is I love to go for walks. And we go for a walk and we didn't have to talk about anything. We just go for a walk. And just being with somebody who was proactively saying, hey, let's do this. And if I said, I don't feel like it, I don't have time, that would have been perfectly okay. Having people like that, that again, are not trying to fix you. They're not telling you it's going to be okay. They're not trying to reassure you. They're not trying to justify anything. They're just there. And they're able to let you be how you are. That's incredibly helpful. The last is the non-people side of it is I've tried a bunch of things over the years and I've learned a bunch of stuff that I now know really work. So, you know, when I'm either depressed or feeling very anxious or exhausted, sleep more, stop drinking, don't drink coffee. I don't wake up with an alarm clock anymore, ever. I just stop doing that. So I wake up when I wake up. Say no to stuff that's going to cause you more stress, right? I need to spend a lot of time myself when I need to recharge. So, you know, spend time by myself, like whatever those things are, do them.
I think you wrote that you woke up with an alarm clock without alarm clock like years ago. And then I said, I remember reading it. It's like, oh, that's a great idea. I should do that. So even helping your sharing tactics is also very helpful.
That one's been transformative to me. I was that guy that woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning, every morning, no matter what time zone I was in. I don't know what ego attachment I had to that stupid thing, but you could do it. Like I could pull it off till about Friday. And then on Fridays I'd maybe, have to sleep until 6, but it was fucked up. And, and I was always tired and I binge slept. I mean, I have this incredible ability to sleep on airplanes. So wheels up to wheels down, I can sleep the whole way. But now I understand it's crappy sleep, right? You're not really getting good sleep. But the other was, I could sleep 12, 14 hours on Saturday.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about ego attachment. I mean,
yeah, sure.
How have are you a deep meditator? Or how have you sort of thought about reducing ego in your own life?
On meditation, I have absorbed something Jerry Colonna from Reboot, who's a close friend, told me early on when I finally started to practice meditating. He said, it's called a meditation practice for a reason. He said, you don't want to get an A. Your goal is not to get an A in meditation, just to practice. And so I have no goals with how I meditate. I have no rhythm. I have to, I don't have to. I just do it when I feel like it. So that's piece one. Piece two is, in terms of ego and ego attachment, I think I have been for a very long time aware of how intrinsically motivated I am. So this has a lot to do with ego, in my mind at least, which is, on a spectrum from intrinsically motivated to extrinsically motivated, people fall on the spectrum, and you're not a savant on either end of it. But extrinsically motivated is, what are those little things in the corner of my picture? They're little hands clapping. I've got 336, and you've got 151, so I must be better than you. Come on, give me some more. I want some more, so I'm better than him. Quick on those things. Give me some more. Yeah, oh, the love. I'm 400 and something now. That's extrinsically motivated, right? I don't give a fuck what that is, but that's, thank you for doing it. Now give Eric some so he can catch up with me a little bit. But that's extrinsic motivation. Intrinsic motivation is the other end of the spectrum, is that something drives you intrinsically that motivates you intrinsically. For me, for many years, it was learning. And part of my struggle with depression in my late 40s was the amount of time I was spending teaching versus learning. I felt like I was spending all my time teaching and none of my time learning. And it was a glitch. Like I realized, oh shit, I'm almost 50. So teaching and learning are kind of the same thing. I learn a lot when I teach, and why can't I just make them the same thing? So I was able to, my engineer brain was able to rewire that. So I think of teaching and learning now as the same thing and as being the intrinsic motivator. So I'm in a good place. I'm in my happy place if I'm teaching or learning. Let me get to ego for a sec, right? So if you think about that, and then I'll carry on with it. If you think about ego, if you're intrinsically motivated, much of the ego dynamic is internal. So the ego is not an externally focused ego. So much of it is with yourself. Am I learning what I want to be learning? Right? And so the result is the external stuff. Again, I said, you're not a savant. I'm not a zero on the extrinsic spectrum, right? But it doesn't mean that much to me. I've actually learned not to be a jerk about it. I used to get awards, and I didn't want to go to the events that I got an award at. And I realized at some point that the award wasn't for me. It was for the organization that was giving the award. Mm-hmm. And that a lot of people like getting the award, so that's fun. For me, it was almost a burden. But then I was helping support the organization, and I learned how to be much more gracious. Yeah, so that's the ego becomes internal rather than external.
Well, how do you... I think almost you're rare in terms of being intrinsically motivated in that we're taught, you know, in high school, right, in college to get the A, you know, we're sort of conditioned to be externally motivated. How do people who are sort of wired to be externally motivated sort of rewire to become intrinsically?
Well, it might not be that you can rewire. It's more, I would actually suggest it's much more of your own journey, mm-hmm. right? So there's a phrase, again, I'll give Jerry Cullen a phrase in airtime. It's called sort of radical self-inquiry. The sort of notion that as humans, it's very, very powerful if we're on this continuous journey of radical self-inquiry. What that means in practical terms is, however, you know, wherever you are on March 29th, 2016, you're going to be somewhere different on March 30th. And you're going to be, you know, continuously learning and changing. And one of the vectors that you can really put a lot of energy into learning and changing is what motivates you and what motivates, what causes you to react positively or react negatively to different stimuli. One of the hardest things to do is figure out how to tune out all the bullshit that has nothing to do with you so that you can start to focus on the stimuli that actually has something to do with you and how you respond to it. An example would be, you know, we're all, you know, not we're all, many people struggle with this. I don't care about the presidential race at this stage. I think it's just complete and total theater. And yet I can't help myself when I see something that I find offensive to make a comment about it to a friend. Or Amy and I were together on Saturday and she likes to read the New York Times on paper. And she was reading something on paper and she tore it out and handed it to me and it was about politics. I don't know if I'll fucking read this, but I can't help myself but read it because it's just so whatever. Figuring out how to tune that out so that you can spend the vast majority of your time on things that you think matter is one of the ways to start to get to this radical self-inquiry, because you're using, or we're using, all that other stuff as noise to procrastinate from putting attention, time and attention to the things that you actually care about.
Yeah. When you rewired in your head that, you know, you should see teaching as learning. I mean, I'm fascinated with this concept of rescripting things. Did you see, did you sort of change the type of teaching you were doing so that it was learning, or did you literally only change the approach that you took?
I don't think I changed how I do much of anything. I think what I did was I added another tag to you know, intrinsic motivation for me. I said, okay, it's been learning, but now it's teaching also. And it was kind of that simple for me. And at first, I tried it out loud a few times, and I kind of felt like it was a little bullshitty at first, right? I mean, that seems too easy. And you know, Amy's reaction to it was actually quite positive. She's like, yeah, like, of course. Right. And a few other people are like, of course. And then it started to sink in. So I don't think it was more profound than that. And I think one of the things about rewiring, I mean, we get rewired when something shocks us. Right. And I use the word shock, you know, maybe it's deliberate. It's like, you know, electric shock therapy actually starts to rewire your brain. Right. You know, a death of a family member, failure of a business, a serious physical accident, a near-death experience, a major relationship blow-up, you know, doing something that you shouldn't have done and then get caught for and have to deal with the consequences of it, whatever that is, whether it's legal or illegal. I mean, those things are shocks that tend to have pretty profound impacts on people. And the opposite is true too, right? There's this reinforcing behavior that's sort of the reinforcing behavior of nonsense, right? If enough people tell you that you're awesome, then of course you're awesome. And then you start thinking you're awesome. And then you start doing stupid shit because you're not thinking about what you're doing. And then all of a sudden you're not awesome anymore. And, oh, by the way, what does it matter if you're awesome or not? Yeah. Who cares? I mean, at the end, we're all going to die anyway, right? So what did that mean? So,
right.
I think for me at least, it's knowing that there's a lot of overhead in our lives regardless, knowing that no matter how disciplined you are, how disciplined one is, it's unlikely that you're going to be extremely disciplined and rigorous about cutting all the noise out, but that part of the way to grow is to get rid of a bunch of the noise and focus on yourself and focus on what matters to you and what you think matters, and then test it against your reality.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I've noticed, obviously, you know, from knowing your work and hearing you talk, the importance, and this might seem silly to even say, but the importance Amy has in your life as a, you know, best friend, as a life partner, as a rock. I'm curious, you know, as someone who, you know, goes all out and everything that he does and tries to improve yourself, what do you think you guys do, you know, as a couple in a relationship that some other, you know, what have you learned that maybe some other couples don't do but should do? Or, you know, what are sort of things that you guys have learned to keep it, you know what I'm trying to ask you?
Well, the first is that, and it's a thing I didn't do well for the first 10 years of our relationship, is that we both make sure that our words match our actions. And I try to have my words match my actions throughout everything I do. And it's not, you know, I fail at that. I make lots of mistakes. But that's a pretty underlying desire. And in our relationship, we hold each other to a pretty high standard in that. The next is when we're together, we're together. And so it doesn't matter where we are. It doesn't matter whether we're in our house or in an airport or in a restaurant or at a friend's house or in the car. We're both present when we're present. And if one of us needs to be not present, we're explicit. I don't pick up my phone while we're driving to dinner and call someone. If I need to call someone, before we get in the car, I say, I need to talk to this person. Is it okay with you if I make this call? And a lot of times she says, no, it's not. And I deal with that. And sometimes she says it is. So, and they go both ways, right? I mean, that sort of being present is both directions. We get together and we have what we call life dinner every month on the first day of the month. And on Friday, I'm actually traveling. So we're going to on Thursday have life dinner instead. So we can move it around, you know, a day or so. It's once a month. It's not date night. Plenty of those. But it's a night where I like to say, if you know agile software development, it's a retrospective and it's our forward planning. We basically, it's the two of us. We have dinner. We have a tradition of exchanging a gift. The gifts could be serious or they could be playful. It doesn't matter. There's no rules about them, except we have to do it. Then we sit and we look backwards and we say, how was the last 30 days? And each person goes, and sometimes the conversation is very short, and sometimes it's very long. Sometimes it's happy. Sometimes there's lots of tears. Sometimes it's very internal. Sometimes it's about both of us. And then we do the same thing going forward. What are we looking forward to in the next 30 days? What do we want to do? What are the things we want to work on together? And it's very much about us as individuals and us as a couple. But the result is there is no more than 30 days that ever elapses between this conversation. So on the 21st of the month, when she gets pissed off at me about screwing something up that annoyed her, she doesn't have to deal with it in real time. She can wait till the end of the month. On the 24th of the month, when she does something that bothered me, I can wait till the end of the month. And by the way, you can be in the moment with each other without having to be, you know,
right,
reacting to everything in the moment. And the end result of it is it makes for a life and a relationship that, if you go back all the way to the beginning, is intentional. And I think this gets harder as you get more stuff in your world. You have more, you know, demands on your time. You have more, I mean, I can't even imagine the demands if you have kids, how that adds into the mix. But businesses, travel, friends, stuff, things. And all of a sudden, as a couple, it's harder to be intentional, because when you started as a couple, your whole world was about the two of you. That was the whole thing. Like, fuck everything else. It's just about us.
Right.
And, you know, 25 years later, the problem in so many relationships is it's all about everything but us. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we've continued to, I would say, put real work into. It's not like, oh, and it just works because she's awesome and I'm awesome and we love each other and we're great. Yeah, it's way more complicated.
The rituals are very important.
Yeah.
How do you balance the tension between being intentional but also sort of letting go a little bit?
Yeah. I have failed at many things. I have had many, many, mostly work and product related things, but not exclusively. I had my first relationship. I got married right out of college, lasted a couple of years, was a total debacle. So early on, I had a failed relationship that was very significant. I was a PhD student. I got kicked out of PhD program because I was a crummy PhD student. I was a good entrepreneur, a lousy PhD student. At the time, I was trying to do both. So I've had a number of things as an adult that I've failed at. At some point, and I think it probably was in the 2001 time period, so when the internet bubble was collapsing and my whole world was in utter turmoil, and I realized, you wake up in the morning and you have a crappy day, and at the end of the day, you do whatever you do to relax, drink a scotch. Now it's legal, so we can talk about it, at least in Colorado, smoke a joint or whatever. And you go to sleep, and when you go to sleep, you're like, tomorrow's going to be a better day. And I realized after about June of 2001 that every day had been worse than the previous day. and you sort of change your frame of reference. Like, it's not that it has to be a better day. It's just going to be a day. And so I think for me, at some point, I have had so many things not work that I stopped having, and I don't think it's ego attachment so much as just attachment to this notion of what is going on. And I wrote a post a while back. I was really wrestling with three words: attachment, detachment, and non-attachment. And the word that actually really spoke to me was non-attachment. That detachment was not what I was trying to do. Detachment is like, I don't care. Mm-hmm. Sort of the opposite of attachment. But non-attachment was not that I didn't care. It was that I was unaffected mm-hmm. by the caring. And, there's a very well-known John Galt line from Atlas Shrugged, which is, it's not that I don't suffer, but that I know the unimportance of suffering. Right? It's kind of it. Good things happen, bad things happen. Gotta deal with it.
Related to ego, I want to make a point. You've been a tremendously successful investor. You mentioned Fitbit. There's a bunch of other ones. Techstars, obviously. You guys could have, raised $1 billion-plus fund, but you guys have chosen to do much smaller funds consistently. And it seems that's a deliberate decision you guys made, and one that took a lot of restraint, because the fees alone would have, made you guys incredibly, incredibly rich. Talk more about that decision.
For a couple things drove it. It was a fundamental part of our strategy when we started Foundry in 2007. The previous firm we'd all been part of, which was Mobius Venture Capital, had raised three funds in relatively rapid succession, 97, 99, and 2000, $300 million, $600 million, and a $1.25 billion fund. And I would say when we started Foundry, we spent a lot of time thinking about what positive things we had learned from the Mobius experience and what negative things that came from it. And one of them was that we decided that we didn't want to build a scaled organization, that we didn't think that what we did, the way to maximize the amount of money we made for our investors, was to build a scaled organization. And, your comment about fees is so telling, is that for any VC, it's cliche, so it's easy for people to say it, but you got to live it. If you're focused on the fee, you're actually not returning value to your investors. The fee is a tax on your investors, right? So in some ways, having a bigger fee is actually just creating a bigger hurdle mm-hmm. for what you're going to do in terms of success for your investors. So there's a lot of stuff to unpack. It takes much longer than probably the 8 minutes we have left in that. But fundamentally, when we started Foundry, we said, we want to get rid of a bunch of noise. And what are the things that create noise, that are inefficient and ineffective uses of our time, where we want to spend as much of our time as possible doing what we think our job is, which is our investors give us a box of money and we give them back a bigger box with more money in it. Lots of different ways to accomplish that. And we didn't have a list of ways to accomplish that, but we said we want to get rid of as many of the things from that that we think are not effectively on that path. Building an organization was one of them. You know, we knew how much time gets spent building and scaling an organization as a venture firm, and you end up having, in some cases, you can see it, venture firms were some of the strongest partners from the investing side are spending most of their time managing and trying to build and lead the firm rather than focusing on investing in companies. Another was that fundraising is a huge time commitment. Even for successful funds, fundraising, there's periods of time where fundraising is relatively easy, but in general, fundraising is very challenging. And by constraining the size of the fund, we basically created a world in which if we were doing well, our existing investors would want to continue to invest with us. And if we weren't, that was a different problem. And so when we raised our first fund, we decided we would raise every fund the same size. And when we raised our second fund, which first one was $225 million, second fund, which we raised 3 years later, was $225 million, we actually had a number of LPs say to us, that has never happened before. Right? Like, you guys could have raised a lot more money, but you chose not to. I'm like, well, we weren't joking. And subsequently, you know, as we've gone forward, we've continued to just raise the same size fund. So, you know, it's not that you have to have a static strategy over time, but it comes back to where we were for a long time, which was this notion of being deliberate. Like, our decisions around how we spend our time are over a long arc very deliberate. There are elements of it that are random. I didn't sit down and figure out how much value I was going to get out of spending an hour doing this. We're not investors in Product Hunt. Why would I do this? Number one, I think Product Hunt's cool. Mm-hmm. I'm a happy user. Number two, I've enjoyed the engagements that I've had with you and with other people in and around Product Hunt. Number three, I've gotten some benefit from Product Hunt. And so I'm happy to engage with it. And I have no idea what comes out of it, but it then becomes part of the philosophy that is deeply woven within everything we've done at Techstars, which is now encapsulated in a phrase called give first, which is this idea of putting energy into something without knowing what you're going to get back.
Right.
Not altruism, but it's a non-transactional relationship, right? I'll put some energy in. I don't know what I'm going to get back, but I expect that I'll get something back from somewhere over some period of time and some consideration. And my own experience is that the amount that I've gotten back by doing a bunch of random things that are within a universe that are interesting to me is orders of magnitude more than I put in. And in the context of what our job is, it actually has been a huge positive enhancer on doing our job.
It's a sort of positive serendipity.
Yep.
I want to close with the last couple of questions. One, what's something that you used to fervently believe that you now see as fundamentally misguided? Basically, something you've changed your mind upon. Maybe it's in business, maybe it's in relationships, maybe it's intellectually or friendships.
I used to think that if I was physically present, I could impact the outcome of what was occurring. That was part of what drove all the travel. Right, something screwed up on the other side of the U.S. I gotta, take a red eye and go work on it. Sometimes I did, sometimes I didn't, but it had no correlation in hindsight to me physically being there. I'll give you another, which is something that I have believed for a long time that many people simply didn't accept, that I think now is becoming more accepted. So let me give you the opposite one, which is, because it pertains to investing as well, which is I have believed for a very long time that you can be an early stage investor without having to be physically near the companies. And in fact, I'm yet to meet a founder who says, I love it that my VC comes and hangs out with me every week. I say that tongue in cheek. I mean, there are plenty of people who spend lots of time with their investors. But when I started investing in the 1990s, the idea that you had to be physically close to your companies at the beginning as a seed or early stage investor was paramount. And I just never believed it. I mean, my investments from the beginning were all over the place. And I learned over time I could only handle the U.S., and that was more of a me constraint because of geography, time, the abstainer-moderator problem. You add a bunch of foreign travel into that mix, and it just gets that much harder. Also, just the expertise around this thing I said earlier about narrowing what you know and what you spend your time on. having done some investments in Europe and having completely failed at them, I realized that there were a lot of things I didn't know and I would have to spend a lot of time to learn and get good at. And I wasn't willing to invest in that. So that's one of the flips. And they're interesting to me. The reason I wanted to say the second one is they're both linked to physical instantiation. I mean, I think 50 years from now, we're going to look back at, you know, our time and how we dealt with physical versus virtual and be amused in the same way we think about the 1800s today.
Lastly, drop a note about us not being the only sentient beings on this planet.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reading Calvin Liu's second book now, Deep Forest. Three Body Problem was the first, and Three Body Problem. I'm almost done with the second one. I love it. The first one had a lot of people who liked it and a bunch of people who didn't like it. And when I went back after I read it and poked around, I couldn't really totally get why people were the negative side of it. The positive side I totally resonated with. If you're interested in science fiction, The Dark Forest is mind-blowing. Like, it's just even so much better. And the book is fundamentally about the U.S., or sorry, the world, Earth, humans, encountering another species, and then what happens over, you know, a roughly 250-year period. And it's so well done in terms of how he approached the problem. It was originally written in Chinese, so it's got this wonderful awkwardness in the translation that makes it even harder and more mysterious and unworldly in some ways to an American science fiction reader. The reason I use that as the backdrop is I've been reading science fiction for a very long time. Like, one of the great, you know, mythologies of science fiction is that there's other beings in the universe. Like, any movie we want to watch, that science fiction movie is talking about, you know, other beings in the universe. Doesn't matter whether it's Battlestar Galactica, you know, or Star Wars. Or Star Trek or whatever. So the human imagination gets this. The scientific dynamics, our scientific limits, and this is a very, very important part of the three-body problem, scientific limits that we have are ones that we don't actually understand what the constraint points are. And if you go back in history and you think about Newton, you know, and there's another really good book. It's not science fiction. It's more science history. Called Vulcan. How the search for a planet and how Einstein destroyed it, or something like that. Another great book because it talks about Newton, Einstein, and the notion that for a long period of time to explain what was becoming essentially the way that Newtonian mechanics evolved into. Theory of special relativity, but before that, how people try to take Newton and apply it, you know, to how the planetary system works. There was actually a belief that there was a planet between the Sun and Mercury called Vulcan. Einstein's thing that he discovered changed the way that with general and special relativity, or the other way around, changed the way that people thought about how that stuff worked. Newton changed the way people thought about how all that stuff worked when he came up with what he came up with. Now, we can make the argument that our ability to understand this stuff is accelerating, but I would make the argument that we don't understand any of this shit. We happen to know it in our small period of time with whatever the constraints are. And, you know, whether it's that there are multiple dimensions and we're living in one, whether there's parallel universes, whether the construct that we've created of a universe is not actually what it is, whether, you know, there's multiple universes that who knows, right? And so we could spend a lot of time thinking about it, but I think fundamentally the answer is it's just completely illogical to me that we are the only sentient beings that exist in whatever the container is of the infinity, right? That theoretically is our universe.
Perfect note to end on. Leave us a lot to think about. Brad's been a pleasure. I want to respect your time. Thank you for being on the Product Hunt podcast. Lastly, just for yourself, any plugs of book upcoming or things to look out for or things people should know about?
I got no plugs that are important. I'll turn it around the other way and say to everybody that's here, you know, if this was useful and interesting, go out and teach somebody something you'll learn.
That's perfect. Thank you, Brad. It's a real honor to chat with you. You've been so supportive, and thank you for all you do for the startup community. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks, man.